Accession number 20601, Reel 1.
Nobby Newell, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In High Wycombe, 21st of February 1923, sorry.
Did your parents both come from High Wycombe?
Yes.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was an electrician, had his own business for many years.
Where did you go to school?
In High Wycombe, only an ordinary elementary school.
What was the name of that school?
Green Street School.
And how old were you when you left there?
14.
So that would have been in 37?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Yes.
Doing what?
I was an apprentice joiner.
So you didn't want to work for your father?
No. Well, I have two other brothers. They both worked for him.
Is that the job you were doing when war was declared?
Yes, yes.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, surely.
What do you remember about that?
Well, young lad, you know, we're at war, that's it. What could you do? Nothing.
Did you feel any sense of dismay?
No, no.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not a great lot, no, no. I mean, I sort of, the firm I worked for went bankrupt and I was transferred to another firm, a local firm. And they were involved in all sorts of war work from the very, very start. We built sort of dozens and dozens of air raid shelters, sort of people coming down from London away from the bombing before it even started, you see. And we were very busy. We did a lot of work on aircraft factories and one thing and another locally. Air screws from Weybridge, they were one of the big ones we did. We were there, I mean, the firm I worked for, they were there for all the war, on and off.
What was the name of that firm?
White Brothers. That's an old Wycombe firm. So, well, it's long deceased now, of course.
So you were doing joinery?
Well, mainly carpentry then. Bit of joinery as and when, but the main it was carpentry.
Were you involved with air raid shelters?
Yes, many of them, yeah. Used to shutter the tops up, that form. Brickwork down below and concrete tops on them.
So you were doing brickwork as well?
Oh, no, only the carpentry end of it.
How much carpentry work was there in an air raid shelter?
Well, whatever the area is, there's a deck, you know, up high level, which the concrete goes on. So that's all up on shores and timber. Timber was very tight, of course. And I mean, there's a fair bit of work. It's rough work, but, you know, by and large, there are other things going along as well.
Did the outbreak of the war affect wages at all?
Not really, no. Well, I mean, I was still an apprentice then. I mean, I think in my final year I was getting, was it 31 shillings, I think. So, I mean, it didn't affect me.
Did you personally do any work for Air Screws of Weybridge?
Well, only at their factory, yeah. Oh, many. I was up there for months and months on end.
At Weybridge?
Oh, no, it's in Wycombe. They bought a local factory. Well, bought it or hired it. It was Castle Brothers, a chair factory, which was a big place. And they just took the thing over.
And what kind of work would you do for them?
Well, we took all the glass out up on the roof, which was hundreds and hundreds of skylights. And they were all taken out and filled with a wooden shutter and then covered with roofing felt to keep them waterproof. And of course, there were lots of works inside to accommodate the new machinery and bits and pieces.
Did you get any bombing in the area?
Very little in Wycombe, just a few odd bombs, and I think they must have been planes just offloading, going back.
Where do you remember bombs falling?
Well, there were one or two down the east end of the town, by the railway line, but they hit nothing, they were, you know, in open ground. Well, one or two roundabout, nothing very much.
Did you have many servicemen in the area?
Yes, because we had Strike Command, which is at Walter's Ash, which is still there to this day. And a bit later on, we had the Americans up at Wickham Abbey, which was their Strike Command.
How did they behave?
As Americans always behave. They got too much money. And look, we hadn't got a lot of money, but they got what seemed like a king's ransom to us. They took the tenner, more or less. All the pubs, anyhow.
Was there any conflict with them?
Well, the odd one now and again. But I must say that the American MPs, I mean, they were very brutal, you know. If a man kicked up in a pub, they used to come in and club him and drag him out and chuck him in a jeep and take him away. As rough as that.
Did you see them do that?
Oh, yeah, many a time.
Would you get English MPs around?
No, one or two Air Force military police, that was all.
Were you in a reserved occupation?
It was a reserved occupation, yeah.
So how did you come to be in the forces?
Well, I suppose I made a nuisance of myself. I volunteered in 1941, which may be about 17 and a bit. And the only regiments I could get in would be the boys' battalions, and I wouldn't have that. I tried about twice, I think, from memory. And then later in 41, I volunteered for the Royal Marines. I'd been in the Home Guard, and with a very good pal of mine. We were both buglers, and we were quite good ones too. And we tried to get in as buglers in the Royal Marines. And that went on, that took them 9 months to call us up, which seemed a hell of a long war to a young man. And finally, when we got called up, they said, well, there's no chance of going as buglers, you'll have to join us ordinary Marines, which we did.
Which unit of the Home Guard were you in?
The 7th Bucks Battalion, G Company.
Have you got any memories about that?
Oh, quite a few, yeah.
Can you tell me about it, please?
Well, I think from memory, I and another old soldier, we did the first guard on the High Wycombe police station. And from then on, it was sort of telephone exchanges, roadblocks, and various other odd bits and pieces. There was one flapping, I think it was in late 40 or early 41. There was an invasion scare which upset the town. Everybody was running all over the place, never heard a thing, never, just stood down about 11 o'clock in the morning. A lot of people say the Home Guard, look, you watch Dad's Army, it's a laughable thing, but believe me, that was very, very serious. And they put them down as a load of old men, but some of those men were there only sort of 50, and they could shoot, I'll tell you. They were good soldiers still. I mean, the training sticks, it doesn't disappear just like that. You know, as for being sort of Dad's Army and a laugh and a joke, it was nothing like that at all. Very serious business.
Had you thought at that time that Germans might invade?
Well, it looked very obvious, didn't it, at the time, yeah.
Would you listen to wireless in those days?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What would you listen to?
Well, whatever was on, I suppose, was ITMAR and one thing or another, those sort of programmes. And I mean, of course, we used to go on parade about 3 nights a week, so that cut the evenings out a bit. Always used to listen to the early morning news when you came off guard at night. And they used to, in those days, they used to play all the national anthems before the news at 6 in the morning of the Allies, of course.
Would you listen to Churchill?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Listen to him whenever he was on, in all the major speeches. Heard most of those.
What effect did his speeches have?
Well, I suppose when you think about it, he was a man who rallied the country. I mean, without him, I think we should have gone under, because no one else seemed to have that sort of drive and go about him.
Would you listen to Haw Haw?
Yes, I listened to Haw Haw quite a few times. And as a matter of fact, when I was a prisoner of war, they asked us if we wanted to get a message to our parents. And I actually had a message on the radio in England while I was a prisoner of war.
What was the message?
Well, just to say I'm all right, look, and all that sort of thing. The general thing, which they already knew, of course. But at least it's your voice, isn't it?
Now, you said you didn't want to be in a young soldier's battalion. Why didn't you want to be in those?
Well, I don't know. I mean, see, my father did 33 years in the territorials in the First World War, and he always alluded to the infantry as the gravel crushers. And in my mind, I just didn't want to be one of those. I mean, I tried to get in the guard, but of course I wasn't tall enough. A great friend of mine took me up. We went to Knightsbridge Barracks, tried to join the lifeguards, and they took my name and that, and I never heard any more. And anyhow, a great friend of mine, a good carpenter, Alan Fryer, he said to me, I don't know why you're messing about like this. He said, why don't you join the Royal Marines? That's the finest regiment we've got in the country. And I think he's right too.
Which unit had your father been in?
My father was in the Royal Bucks Hussars in 1902. And of course, when the war broke out, I think they were at camp, and they were mobilised straight away. He was squadron quartermaster sergeant for a start, and then after about a year, which would be 1915, he became regimental quartermaster sergeant, and he served with them until I think it was early 18, and then he was transferred to the machine gun corps, of which he became RQMS, no sorry, RSM. And he served there until 19 when he came home. From then on, he was in the 394 RA battery artillery in Wickham. And he stayed there until he was finally thrown out, you know, because of age.
Now, can we pick up with your joining Royal Marines, please?
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, after waiting 9 months, we were finally called up on March the 21st, 1942, and we went to the recruiting office in Reading, at London Road, Reading, and there were about half a dozen of us. We were put on a train down to Limpstone in Devon, and we went down there, and we were received about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we and a lot more, like, who came from the Midlands and one place and another. We became 332 Squad, Royal Marines.
What kind of experience did you have at Limston?
Well, it was the initial training, of course. A lot of arms drill and foot drill. And, of course, the Marines are very, very proud of this, and still today the same. They're very proud of their drill and one thing or another. Elementary sort of field training. Warring procedures, you know, and all that, which really came from the First World War. We were there 6 weeks. Colour Sergeant Peters was our instructor, who was a very fine man, a King's Badgeman. And after 6 weeks, we were then moved on.
What were these wiring procedures?
Well, if I remember right, it's going back to the barbed wire fencing, look, to protect trenches and one thing or another. I mean, I remember doing double apron fences with all the warring procedures, all the methods of doing it, who does what, and how the parties split up, and all that sort of thing. And I mean, that lasted quite a bit, because I still, when I was tightening the wire up, I still use the same procedure.
How do you wire?
Well, if you were going to put a wire fence up, you use the same method of tightening up as you did then, which is a windlass in process, usually with a piece of wood in this case. You put it through when it's loose and twist it round and round and round, and you've very soon got it tight.
And then how do you secure the wood?
Well, you take it out, throw it away. That's only a method of tightening the wire up, you see.
Any other memories of Linston?
We had Exeter was bombed quite heavily while we were there. They had a lump of shrapnel, I suppose, as big as a sheet of foolscap on the square in the morning. I think some of our people went into Exeter and helped clear the place up. Probably some of the older intake.
Was any damage done at Linston by the Exeter raid?
I don't think so, no.
And then?
Well, from there we went off to Hayling Island. We went. Sergeant Shepherd picked us up. He was the instructor from Hayling Island. He came and picked the squad up. We went down to Hayling Island, which was near East Oak Point. And we were in several houses there. I think our house was Bermuda. They were taken over from the civilians, you know. And that was field training only there. We did a fair bit of rifle range work. Learned how to bivouac and tent one another. We stood by every third night. They used to run us round the beach, which is all stones down there. Pillbox number 6, which would be about 3/4 mile away, you would run double down there with all your weapons and Bren guns and boxes of ammunition, and sleep on a concrete floor with no blankets at all. Never allowed to take your equipment off.
What was your quality as a shooter?
Oh, pretty good.
Had you had any experience prior to Home Guard?
Always been involved with guns all my life.
How was that?
Well, my father was interested. We always had air rifles, in fact, we did have rifles, an old rifle at home, even in those days. And we had the small shotguns, which we used to shoot the starlings and the sparrows and running another roundabout. Air rifles, always target shooting.
How were you enjoying Royal Marines training so far?
Very much so. Really enjoyed it. People say they don't like it, but I enjoyed it. I mean, there was strong discipline, and discipline's the thing that makes it.
Any other memories from Hayling Island?
We used to watch them at night bombing Portsmouth, which isn't very far away across the water, and. Well, I don't know really. I know the Navy used to come down to East Oak Point and get in the landing craft down there and be away. We used to laugh at them because they couldn't march in step.
And then?
From then the whole squad moved back to Devon to Dulwich, which was the holding camp, and we were in there and presumably just waiting for a draft. We were on fatigues while we were waiting. And then we had a draft to go to Lightakack, and we all went on leave. After 4 days, I was recalled. And I had to have an interview with a major of the Royal Marines Engineers. And he said, I've looked at your records and you are a joiner and a carpenter. He said, we want you in the... We want you in the engineers. Well, he said, think about it. He said, you're under no pressure at all. And then he said, well, what do you think? I said, well, I'll be honest, I joined the Royal Marines to fight, not to be a carpenter. And he said, all right, son, I appreciate your thoughts, that's it, forget it. Well, of course, the thing was, I lost my squad. I had the pleasure of watching them all march out the gate and finish with. And I was on fatigues there for several weeks. I got involved in the carpenter shop. I used to make the targets for the shooting, you know, the shooting practice. And the carpenter there said to me, look, well, what do you know about this? So I said, well, not a lot. And he said, well, can you make these targets? Well, he said, yeah, well, I made them in very quick order. He said, well, you must know what you're doing. I said, well, of course I do. He said, well, I'm a carpenter in the engineers, he said, but we don't know anything about this really. And I was at that for quite some time. all the odd people used to come back from various battalions. If a man had had pneumonia or an injury, he would come back to this holding company, and you know, they'd have a company of 120 men, and they would I mean, they were very proud of the battalions and that they came from. And O'Leary, who was a Captain O'Leary, who was a ranker, been a drummer in his days. He was a very strict man. He missed nothing. He knew all the wrinkles. There was no way you could get by him. And he used to march down the ranks, and he used to say, "Sir Major Bell, turn these men about. I can't see the sun's in my eyes." And they would turn about on the road, you know, on the road of the camp, until he was the right way around, and he'd come along and he'd say, "Shave, shave, haircut, shave, shave." And one or two of these chaps would still have their divisional marking on their arms. And his thing was, "Get that bloody rubbish off your arm." Well, he was a bit of a martinet, there was no doubt about that. I mean, we used to have film shows in the camp in the gym. I used to show a reel of film and then change it while you sit and wait and show the other reel. And one night we'd been to the pictures and we got back to the hut, and there was a scuffle outside and a banging of the door, and in came O'Leary. He's only about 5'2" or 5'3" tall, with a bloke at least 6 foot tall. And he got hold of him and he held him against the bunk and he looked at me. He says, "I shall remember your face. I caught you urinating in the company lines." Now, the thing about that man was, he sorted him out of 120 men the following morning. He knew him, and he had him, and he had, I think, 7 days appearing at the guard room, 5 minutes after Reveille and 5 minutes before light day, in full marching order every day. And that doesn't say much, but what it really means, you have to, overnight, you put your equipment together, the marching order, and then when you've done that first parade, you then got to strip it all down and put it on the shelves in the correct order, you know, stacked above the shelves all ready. And then again at night, you've got to put that lot together again to go out onto your evening parade and the morning parade, and that goes on, and that takes a long time.
Why do you think this chap had urinated in the company lines?
Pub?
Why do you think this Marine had urinated?
Well, I mean, the toilet was probably 400 or 500 yards away, and very crude at that too. I could see no problem really, because it's all sort of heathland with trees and that. I mean, I could see no problem there really. But the fact is, it was amongst the huts.
Whereabouts in Devon was this?
This is, I think it's Woodbury Row actually. It's Woodbury Common, and the camp's name is Dalditch.
And it's near Limpston?
About 6-7 miles from there.
Any other memories from this time?
Well, not really, no.
What happened next?
Well, the day finally arrived when I had a draft chit, and I was sent to the 5th Battalion Royal Marines in Carmarthen. I was the only one going there. And, I mean, you know, that sounds all right, but you realise you've got everything. You've got a cart a lot. You can't leave a rifle anywhere. You can't leave your kit anywhere. You've got to drag it with you. Anyhow, I got down to Carmarthen about 9 o'clock at night, and I went into the RTO, which is usually run by the engineers, and I said, "Can you tell me where the 5th Battalion Royal Marines are?" "Yes, boy, straight down the road," which was about 2 or 3 miles, I suppose. Anyhow, he said to him, I said, "Well, if can I leave my pack and my so-and-so here?" "Yes." So anyhow, I then walked down the road and found this place, went in the guard room. The sergeant of the guard said, "Where you come from?" And I told him. He said, "Right, put your rifle and stuff in the guard room." He said, "We'll go back and fetch your pack and your bag." And when he got there, he said to this chap in the engineers, he said to him, he said, "Now this boy's been all day getting here." He said, "Don't you think you could have picked up the phone and phoned the camp? You have the number." And he could have been picked up. he says, you're right sitting in this office, I expect you'll sit here the rest of the war. And he worked him over a little bit, and the bloke could say nothing.
What then?
Well, I then went to C Company. Captain Bridges was the OC, and from then on we did all the usual training, interminable route marches, a bit of field firing, a bit of drill, everything that you would normally do, and it really terminated in, I think, November. We did an exercise in the Black Mountains, Exercise Berwyn, and we went by lorry a fair way, and then we stopped and we slept in a field, and the bugle sounded falling in the morning, about 4 or 5 o'clock, and as he sounded, so that started raining. And we were there, the exercise was 7 days, but we were to become the rear guard, and we had 8 days there. It was very, very cold. It never stopped raining. We were wet through from day one. All over the hills there, I've been down that way many times since. I can't locate it. I mean, I know we went through Tregaron on the way home, but I never did really find where we went there, because these little mountain roads, you just don't remember them after a while. There's nothing there to mark it. I know we were sent on the seventh night. Sergeant Bush, who was my platoon sergeant, he collared hold of me and Dusty Miller, who came from London, and he said, "Now you two, look across there." And we looked away across the valley, and about 2 or 3 miles away was a ford with a bridge over it. He said, "Sergeant Major Ogden will be down there with a 1500 weight truck, and he will have the rum ration with him." He said, "Now you go down there and fetch that back, and for Christ's sake, don't spill any." And here we came back with a bottle and an odd, I think it was a water bottle full as well. And of course, by then it was pitch black. And we wandered, we went through the swamps. We got no idea where we were. There wasn't a star to be seen. It was dark, pitch black. And I think about 4 o'clock, this would be about 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening to start with. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, a voice says, "Halt, who goes there?" And I knew the voice, so he said, "Called Happy Perry, I'm glad to see you." And there was Sergeant Bush there with all the mess tins in a row. And he said, "We've been waiting all night for this rum." And he went along with a little cup and he measured it 8. And then he went along again and measured it 8. And his exact words were, "Now, have your rum, put a drop of water with it if you've got any sense, but if not, drink it like it is. And if there's any left, save it for Sergeant Major Ogden, because he'll drink every drop of rum you can find." Anyhow, we finished the exercise there. I mean, it was more a case of survival than anything else. It finished with a field firing exercise down into a valley below us with what they call steel tiles, which when you hit them with a rifle fire, they topple over. And I believe Churchill was there to view the final bit. So they always said he was there. I never saw him. And from then on, we just marched back a fair way, and then finally caught some lorries and got back to camp at Carmarthen. And my two big toes, I never felt them for months. They were dead white. And I suppose it was probably nearly frostbite. I don't really know. But, I mean, been wet through all the time with no chance of drying anything. And it wasn't long after that we left Carmarthen, and we went boat training at Inverary in Scotland. Inverary was a well-known place for boat training, and we went up, I think, to Glasgow, and from there on we went up the locks in a transport of some description. And when we got there, we went into Army Camp Number 2, which is just beyond Inverary Castle, and it's up a valley. I've been there and looked at it. It doesn't mean a thing to me anymore. But we were in a camp there, and we we've been in there, and the Americans have been in the camp before us. And when they went down to the Naffy or the dining halls, which were down the bottom of the hill, they never walked anywhere. They used jeeps and transport, and the place was almost impassable. It was very, very wet and muddy and...